Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only...
Only.
Micro-broadcasting radio station. I am Nicholas Miller, and I am not in the K-Chung studios with Steve Cato this week because of the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown.
The novel coronavirus.
Yeah, we've been closely monitoring the situation for about 12 months now. And our good friends at Tiger Dry Lac Powder Coating, also monitoring the situation, have told us that things are lightening up, perhaps. Although it's funny that, you know, every single site of commerce was monitoring the situation, but we never really got any news from them, did we?
No, so far, Paul Soto Gallery has not updated me about the pandemic yet. I'm disappointed to say that I have not received any recent news from Paul Soto Inc. And regarding
the progress
of this pandemic.
I was expecting Tiger Dry Lac, Paul Soto, and The Gap to really, you know, help me understand step by step how this virus was cutting through the world. But alas,
who to turn to if not The Gap, Tiger Dry Lac, Paul Soto Gallery, Kane Griffin Corcoran, etc.
Cookbook.
Oh yeah, Cookbook. I hope Cookbook lets me know what's going. You know, to be fair, Cookbook is actually like very close to a major vaccination site. Like if there was one of these businesses that actually like could sort of like go up to the roof and take a peek. And like let you know how things are going. They could at least like get a decent view of Dodger Stadium, I feel.
Right?
You know, like they're nearby. They could stick their head out their door, you know, go around the corner, check out the scene at Dodger Stadium, be like, long lines.
Yeah.
No line. Come on in, you know.
Right. I mean, I talked to our friend of the show, Ignacio, the other day. And, you know, his
talk to him.
Mom's lives here now. And he was struggling to find a vaccine for her. But then he said a friend of his posted on Instagram that some new vaccines had dropped at Dodger Stadium. And it was, much to everyone's surprise, was true. So it was kind of like a vaccine drop.
Wild.
Yeah. So there, you know, I guess not that surprising that sneakers are setting the structure through which these are being disseminated. But... you know, the drop is a good model, I'd say, for commerce.
Sad. It works very well for commerce. I mean, obviously, the big problem here is that there's still patents and intellectual property associated with these vaccines, right?
Sure.
Like, we could all just, think about the amount of idle manufacturing capacity that's just not making the vaccines we know to work because they are not Pfizer.
Yeah, they're all working on Charles Ray sculptures.
Or whatever.
I'm just kidding.
You know? But yeah, there's just all this manufacturing capacity that's not making any of the things we think we need.
No, you know? Of course. Yeah. There's, I guess, Biden supposedly enacted some wartime act. You know, like what you see the images of everyone, including housewives, making airplanes in World War I and II or whatever. But it doesn't seem like it's working that way.
Well, it hasn't disrupted the intellectual property thing. So, like, I think that's like...
That's the problem.
They can't
just have like, you know, start the production, say at the, you know, at the Nike factory and then have the Pfizer guy come in and add that last magic ingredient.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
I mean, whatever. I mean, of course, we all still need Advil or whatever else is being manufactured. But, you know, like there is a lot of pharmaceutical manufacturing capacity in the world. Mm-hmm. Most of it's not even in this country. Right. So it's not even up to Joe Biden. You know, it's like up to I suppose, global regulators to like break the patent on Pfizer. So like Joe Biden could do that. Then the patent would be the information would be out there. And then most of the pharmaceuticals in the world are made in India. So then everyone, all the factories in India could just like turn on, you know, and start making the stuff. But
this is what I understand from the second to last Jason Bourne movie, where he needs to go to the pharmaceutical manufacturing plant to lock in his genetic alterations, which I think in that film is in Southeast Asia somewhere.
Well, you know, it's not totally inaccurate.
Yeah. No, so, I think they're paying someone big bucks to do that research, make sure it's all really, really nice and tight.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of organic processes, one of the things that I think about every week, regardless of whether I talk about it very publicly, is I think a lot about open source software.
Oh, do you?
I use this amazing package called Emacs, which started off as a Lisp interpreter and has just like run off with itself to become something much more useful than that. And I know that you're in the similar boat because you use some stuff that is like open source as well, right?
For work. I'm embarrassed to say I don't really. Our guest tonight, I should be using his software, but it wasn't what I was brought up on, you know. I was brought up on like a very tony English bit of software.
Cool.
And you know, and just hooked to the high life.
Well, once you get tied to the mast of a closed source software package, you cannot untie yourself. You just hear the beautiful siren song.
I don't even hear suffer. It, you know. I got, because I put the honey wax or beeswax in my ears.
So you're both the oarsman and Odysseus at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's the way I relate to the working class.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, yeah. So you're not doing the hard work, but you also don't benefit.
I wear the clothes.
That's like the true PMC. That's like the that is the PMC's predicament. You don't get to be, you don't get to hear the beautiful song, but you also don't have to row.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with that note, I'd like to introduce one of the great open source software, I guess you'd call him an entrepreneur of our time, and a totally decent guy. That's a rare sentence. Everyone put their hands together, move to the edge of your seats. Tonight we have Ton Ruzendahl.
So Ton, it's I've been wanting to interview you for like 6-7 years.
You did?
Yeah.
I forgot.
Yeah.
At the Blender conference.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And who would have thought it would happen in L.A., a place where neither of us are from? But we got the cameras here. Tom's here. Why not?
All the important people are in Los Angeles. That's why we met.
So they say. Yeah. I want to know, because I know very little, but what is your background? What have you always been interested in programming?
No, I studied industrial design. It's, you know, to make products, product development. I actually wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
But I met some guy in a bar one night when I was, wanted to pick a study, and he said, oh, industrial design is so cool because it's and creative and technical, right? And I liked those, already liked that, to do something creative and technical. Uh-huh. So I decided to start a company to have money to buy more expensive and bigger computers, mm-hmm. and to work full time as a computer graphics designer and to do animation, especially 3D.
How old were you then?
That was when I was 29.
Okay.
That was Neo Geo. And that name, we were first. The game console was also called Neo Geo. Didn't exist then, so we had that name. And it means Neo Shape. Geo is a form.
Shape. Oh, okay.
Geo.
Yeah.
New shape. Ah, fun, right? It's, it's Greek, I think, not Latin.
Ah.
Anyway, if you want to be cool, huh?
Yeah.
We had a nice name, and we started a studio in Eindhoven. I did it together with a business partner. We got some employees, and suddenly we had like 7 people working for us. Doing computer graphics. So that's where Blender started, in that environment.
Hmm.
So I was doing the client, and I was doing the art direction, and I was also writing software.
Hmm.
And at first I didn't. I thought, come on, my business partner, he wrote software. I said, come on, we are not a software company, we are a design company. So what are you doing all day programming? But it was fun, and I could see that. I thought, okay, let me try a little bit. Oh, wow, yeah, this is really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, coding is really fun. You ever tried coding?
No.
Come on, HTML pages, like
AI,
kind of stuff. Okay, that's all very fun.
I did it in school, yeah. Visual Basic as well.
A little bit JavaScript or Python. No, nothing?
No. Visual Basic.
Yeah, Visual Basic.
HTML. I did that in school, yeah.
So it stuck really with me. I really like it because you can really focus on that for days and weeks. And then you can make something that works. Uh-huh. I thought the first thing you try is a ray tracer. And you have some mathematics and lines and you bounds and you have normals and some basic high school mathematics. And you can code a ray tracer.
Yeah.
And then you say, oh, that's cool. Now, how do you add a text here? Well, you have to add some weird formulas and see what happens and how that looks. And then you try to make it faster and optimizing it. And then you want to have a modeler, of course. So you try to look at how does that work and how do you make that interaction work. And then slowly, it started already in 85 on the Amiga. I did some development, but the real work started more like in 91.
Yeah.
When we bought our first big computer, the Silicon Graphics, and it was in those days the brand for 3D computers, because you had a graphics card that could do real-time wireframes and solids. Real-time. And the Amiga, you had to render a wireframe.
So you didn't even know what it would look like.
It was not real-time wireframes. It was line. You had to wait 5 seconds and you had a wireframe.
Whoa.
So what you had real-time was bounding boxes. That's why Blender still has bounding boxes for as a prototype. And it started in those days. That was the only interactive mode you had with bound boxes. And then you had to press enter and then you saw the wireframes.
Huh.
But for sure you would not have any solid rendering at that time. But in 91, we bought a Silicon Graphics. It costed the equivalent of $60,000 for one computer.
You bought from Silicon Graphics? Yeah. $60,000?
All our profits, everything we made, we put in one computer.
Wait, hang on. How long, when did you start Neo Geo?
In 89. So after 2 years, we were running okay, but it was all with Amigas.
Yeah.
And then all the money we made, we bought one computer. And we didn't have money for the software. So that was, Alias was available, I think Softimage and a couple of others. But Alias would cost you another $60,000. So yeah, that was 94. 95, Blender was more or less functional, but we could do the first projects with it. And at that time, the software was totally designed to work for the projects we do. And then I made all kinds of design decisions that you can still see nowadays in Blender. And some of them were very fortunate and really good.
Mm-hmm. Give me what's an example?
For example, I used a subdivision interface. In those days, every program would open in 20, 30 different windows, and you had to lay out all of that yourself. And then everything you would do, it would pop up something, and you have to fill in the stats to say okay, and then it would apply it, right? And there was a blocking interface which was overlapping. And I thought we should not do that. We should have a flat interface which you subdivide and you assign functions and editor type to a subdivision thing. And if you want to have two editors next to each other, you should be able to do that. Or you have two windows, you can have that too. But it was basically one window from start with a subdivision, and you make a layout at the screen, and then you can swap those layouts in and out and have your editors configured.
Where did you get that idea from?
You get that idea by thinking and analyzing.
So right? You didn't read any user design books?
I don't remember. Huh. I mean, I was inspired by web browsers. In those days.
Oh, web browsers.
The first web browser started.
Yeah.
And the internet pages did not have the possibility to open windows.
Right.
Maybe now, the people hate that anyway, because you have a web, and you don't want the web to pop up things, right?
Yeah.
So they tried to design web pages that were flat, and they had columns and tabs and stuff, or frames, they call them, to work. Oh, it was very efficient.
Yeah.
I have to go back to my story of the Blender.
Okay, so 1999 we're up
we
to.
We had 95, 96, we had the first Blender version. In 98, I sold the company.
You sold the company?
Not for much money, but
Neo Geo, the company.
Okay. I could take the software and then say, okay, because the whole industry went down.
Really?
There was not a lot of money anymore for all this visualization stuff and for video programs. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to have either games or internet, but the internet came up. You have to go to the internet and interactive media and everything. Boring, right? Who wants to do internet stuff? Everybody's doing internet stuff. I want to do something nobody is doing. For example, making a 3D tool. So I decided to start a new company to have Blender there, put it on the web. I make a website, get forums, and see what happens if I give away the software. And that was 98, and the Blender, the first version was published. First, only the Silicon Graphics version, and then within a few months I had a Linux version, FreeBSD, and then I got an employee, my first, and he helped make the Windows version for Blender. And that happened within 1 year.
Where did that idea of giving it away for free come from? Open source?
In the first a year of the Not a Number company, that's the company I founded to market Blender, we didn't have open source. Blender was free, but it was not fully free. So there were some features locked, and I sold keys, and the B key and the C key. And if for $50 or $100, you got a key, and that would unlock more stuff in Blender. That was how I got my first money, and also to get to SIGGRAPH and present Blender. But then I got investors on board in the internet bubble. I was there with two people in a little office in a startup center. And there were people coming in. Oh my God, your company is worth $10 million. Huh? Right, $10 million, sure. But you have to be very strong to resist that opportunity.
Yeah.
Because they said, right, Tom, you can get $5 million investment money, and then we'll make you really big, and we hire 50 people, employees, and you can become a billionaire or whatever. So you have to try if you get that opportunity. It was fun. So yeah, I got an investor on board, at first $4.5 million, or later $1 million more. And then we
really? You got $1 million of investing? Four and a half?
Total $5.5 million.
What?
Money, real money.
What happened to it? Where did that...
All that money. It burned. It was a big fire. What do you call it? A vanity bonfire.
Okay.
Well, okay, you watch the TV series Silicon Valley.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my favorite. But it's actually true. It happens like that. It's actually true.
How many people did you hire at the most?
50.
50 people?
So yeah, I was with two, and like a few months later, we had 50.
That's crazy.
That was crazy.
So you really just burnt all the money.
We had a big booth at SIGGRAPH, and we went to the Game Developers Conference, and business meetings in the Bay Area, of course, flying business class, going to Japan, and everything.
Really?
Yeah. It was not a bad time.
And they were investing so that you would make the software huge and make them more money.
So the business model was to keep the software for free,
okay,
to give it away, and then make professional services around it. And we had fantastic stuff. We had a 3D web plugin, a 3D on the web. So you could save a Blend file, and you had a plugin working in the browser, and then that Blend file would load the Blend file, and you would see your stuff.
Really?
Including complete games. The whole game engine was running on the web as a web plugin.
Wow.
Well,
the first sketch
10, 15 years too early.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. So that was fantastic. It was good. Very new. But how do you make money with that?
Right? Yeah.
You can only do this if you get like 5 years that you can develop. You have to develop the market. And then you can start growing a customer base and try to find out where the real money is. But we didn't. As I said, the internet bubble bursted. And the investors said we had they wanted an exit within 9 months.
Hmm.
So the investors called me in, said, Tom, we're going to stop this. And we're going to put your blender in a drawer here and lock it up. And you can better do something else. But this costed us so much money. And at that time, of course, I had nothing left. So in the beginning, I owned 100% of Blender. And I ended up with 10% still.
So you had to buy back Blender, essentially.
Basically.
Right.
But that took a while to convince them. And that was the famous free Blender campaign that happened in 2002 in the summer, when within 7 weeks we got 110,000 euros and dollars, which is the same amount, collected via the community.
So you
and
asked
that was
the
what I negotiated with the investors. I said, well, let's be fair. Blender is not worth anything at the moment. It's 2002. There's a crisis. Nobody invests anymore. Nobody would buy this software without me because it's totally ununderstandable piece of shit with Dutch comments in the code and stuff. So without me, it's not worth a lot. So okay. Here's a proposal. I will do a campaign online to collect money from the users, and I will get you 100,000 euros as a license to make Blender open source. So you keep the rights, but you give it away as open source, or you publish it as open source. Under the most strict license, the GNU GPL is considered to be a very extreme license that only allows software to stay free. And you cannot use the Blender code in a commercial product unless you make that commercial product open. So that's why Blender is always free. It has to be free forever. That's in the license. That's how this system works. So if you own the rights of a piece of software which is licensed as GNU GPL, like Blender, you can still have the same copyright and put it yourself in a commercial product. And you can sell that. That's how the license works.
And that's how someone is able to sell Blender on the eBay or whatever?
Yeah, they can.
Legally,
They can do whatever. But for as long as you give them the software.
Yeah.
Anyway, so in 7 weeks' time, we had the money, and that was amazing.
What year? What year is this?
2002.
Okay.
Yeah. You were not using Blender, though. You were still in high school or so, doing things.
I started using it 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess, a couple of years later.
1 year later.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. It is unofficially, that I think, the first crowdfunding ever.
Is it really?
Yeah. Because we had perks and we had things.
Did you really? You had perks.
Even people could make a promise. They said, well, you have to sign that you pay a certain amount of money, but if you get the goal, then you have to cash.
Ah, look at that. Early Kickstarter. You were ahead of the time.
5 years. I'm always ahead of the time. You try to do something because nobody does it, right? That's fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I suddenly had an open source project. So I had to read up about open source, how that works and stuff. But originally, I thought it would not work. That open source thing is not, But it was mainly for me as a little monument to have Blender online and the software for the users so that they can always keep using it. And also for everybody who worked on it, had the developer team in the company, that they could take that software and show it to the other companies or use it further. So it was more like a symbolic wrap, more than a new future. And within a year, I found out that it was actually working. And making Blender open was totally the best thing I could ever do.
Yeah.
And suddenly you got a whole interesting community dynamic going on, right? And the community, as you know, they don't really listen to what you tell them to do. They have their own ideas.
Yeah.
So they started working on things. I thought, what? That's not important. Why don't you work on that? Like this fantastic web plugin and all the stuff, 3D on the web, imagine. And nobody was interested. You know what they did? They fixed the modeler. because they wanted to model, they wanted to use the software for creating things. And they were right. Of course that's important, right? And that's what you get if you get communities involved. They're not always wrong. I mean, a lot of people actually do really, really good stuff. And they do what they think is important. It's what is in their interest. Yeah. More than what they think, I have a dream, I have a vision of how the internet will look like in 10 years. Not interested, right?
Right.
Things should work today or tomorrow, or I want to have it now. Mm. I'm not going to invest in something that takes 10 years. And certainly not in open source. Right? They always like very short-term little things to move on. But then you can see, okay, I can help with that. You only need one little thing, like to fix tool tips or something. Okay, I can handle that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's how you grow the community, and that's how the developers got on board.
Could I ask, at that time when you made it open source, did you ever imagine that it would be this many years later with
no.
as big as it is?
Totally not.
What did you think was going to happen?
At first I thought nothing would happen. But it would be there, and it would slowly fade away.
Really?
Like, it was fun for people that they could still use it. Many programs died.
Yeah.
If you look at it in the past, a lot of projects, they have some interest from people, and then they all move on, and they go somewhere else. I think it didn't happen for Blender for a couple of reasons. Of course, one is there were no competitors, right? There was nobody having a functional 3D creation tool in open source.
Mm. Also, there's no open source competition.
There was no, in the open source world, there was
right.
no competition. So, and also not a renderer. Yeah, okay, there were some renderers. But the production, it was production ready, right? You could do cool stuff with it. It had some hair, it had some this, it had a video editor, textures. There was a lot of interesting things going on. Character animation. You could do things in Blender.
Mm.
And that was a complete creation package, as it is now, but it was then too. So with one program, you could start it up, and then you end up with a finished product, like something, a film, or a clip, or a presentation, or a visualization, or a little game. But everything is possible to do in one program. Mm. And that makes Blender special too. Because people can put their whole life in it, right? In the morning they fire it up and then they make things. And it's just with one program. And that's special. I mean, with GIMP or with Inkscape or Photoshop or OpenOffice. So you don't have that very special relationship with a piece of software.
Mm.
And so that made Blender special. And of course, Blender was not that bad, right? It had a couple of good concepts behind it. And a couple of really good developers with smart brains got on board. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, that's fun. Well, let's see what happens. And then there's community dynamic. And of course, everybody was really proud that they got the money together. So there was all lots of good vibe to make something happen. But the first year, I hardly didn't do anything for it. I only set up the foundation and the website and make sure that everybody could work. Because I really wanted to see what are people going to do? What is the focus of what will they pick up? Or how does it work? I have to learn it.
Hmm.
And then later on, I picked up programming again, and especially maintaining the Mac version for Blender.
I had no idea that Blender had such a corporate beginning. Like you were had $5 million, 50 people. That sounds like the start of an Autodesk story or something.
Yeah.
How did you go from pursuing the money to then suddenly going like, everything is free? What was, did something change in your...
No. But I was never interested in money. Money doesn't mean anything. It's not interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I call myself a maker. I want to make stuff. Yeah, whether that's software or 3D or designs or building teams or companies, or I want to make stuff. That's my passion, and the money is a means. And sometimes you need it to do something big. So you have to work, make money, and then you can do something with it. But the real satisfaction is in making something. That's making Blender, I'm making the foundation, making books, I'm making the training DVDs, and later I'm making the films. Mm-hmm. And doing a software business, that was an option. I mean, after the bankruptcy, we also looked at, okay, maybe we can make Blender commercial and then do it very cheap, like for $50 or so, and with two or three developers and continue it as a small company. But that's simply something I didn't like.
Mm, right.
It would be too uninteresting. And then you had to sell software. It's boring. Right? On the internet, it gets a bit easier. You know, with the App Store and stuff, you have ways to monetize things. But in those days, or the way how Cinema 4D and other programs have to sell software, it's half of your money and overhead goes to the sales department or more. You have to set up a typical business that's very sales-driven, and then you only have a few clients and you make it for them. And the only relationship we really have with them is that they pay you and then you give them something back for it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like something I want to do. Mm-hmm. That's not my maker thing.
How many people work for the foundation at the moment?
But the foundation doesn't have employees.
Okay.
So there's the institute.
Sorry. So the institute. How many people does the institute have?
So the foundation, to be clear, the foundation is the public benefit. That's the safe. And it's a real foundation. And the foundation should only be used to make sure that there's always continuity. For all the copyright is there, the ownership of Blender.org, the website URLs, the registrations. A lot of copyright on the Blender software is in the foundation. And the foundation has a non-commercial, non-profit goal, public benefit. So whatever is there is meant to help the goal, keep Blender free, and help people to use Blender. Mm. The Institute is something I started in 2007. After the first open movie.
Okay.
And that movie business is what I brought back after 5 years of open source development, because I thought it was all going a little bit into a very nerdy, technical, typical open source world, where the programmers are telling everybody what they have to do. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of people hate open source projects so much. Mm-hmm. And they all say, yeah, they're most bad, sucky interface ever, and they don't listen to users, and they're only interested in their own beautiful, nice code. And I didn't want that. I like to work with artists. I'm a creative person myself. I don't think beautiful code or fantastic, well-designed software is interesting. What I'm interested in is working software. If it works, right, then we have something good. And if something beneath there is ugly and horrible, then okay, you should fix that one day, but it works, right?
Mm.
Way more important than things that are beautiful, but they don't work.
Hmm.
There's so many people say, look at my code, it's the most beautiful code ever, and then nobody uses it. Why is nobody using my fantastically beautiful code? Well, maybe because it's not usable, right? Or not interesting for users to have.
Right.
So that's the thing I wanted to bring back, and that's why I started the Blender Institute at a studio there to make frequently films or even a game, to get artists on board to work together with the developers to always make sure that whatever we do, there's always a user breathing down your neck telling you, yeah, that's nice, but I would like to have working hair, and I want to have combing tools, and I want to have better rendering, I want to have global illumination, and I want to have what? So the things you actively need for production.
Yeah.
Not the things you need because the community votes for it.
So Elephant's Dream was 2006?
Yeah.
And then that's when you made the Institute. And what was that? Big Buck Bunny? 2007
and 8, and then with the Shintel, and every film had their own technical targets.
Yeah.
Elephant's Dream, the whole animation system was redone, and we had our first compositor built in Blender, 2005 and 6.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy, and the node systems, we could do materials and stuff. What? Yeah. Now, for Big Bang Bunny, it was mostly a character animation, further improvements for deformation, and hair, fur, combing, grass, all that kind of stuff. High quality rendering as well, so better anti-aliasing. For Sintel, we did the 2.5 project. To get rid of a lot of shitty old interface code.
What year?
For Sintel in 2010, and it was 2.5.
Yeah.
When we did a lot of work on the interface. You remember that?
I remember that project. Yeah.
So that was a big leap.
Yes.
That was a big leap.
It was.
People thought at first, Blender was really weird.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it became less weird. Huh?
Yeah.
It was like, oh, I recognize some of those things. And they were, it was a little bit more accessible, but better structured.
Yeah.
And especially we added a way, I don't know, what I'm mostly proud of, in 2.4, if you would slide a value for a button, you had to release it to see an effect.
And what?
You had to release the button, and then you saw an update.
Oh, right.
For everything you did in the interface, every widget, every tool, every button you did, it was not live updated.
Right.
You had to do it, and then you had to update. And you had to update. And suddenly, things were all parallel. Remember that?
I remember the first time I used it was like the particle system. So it was running these particles down, and then I increased the number of particles, and they go...
Wow, the thing is running.
And you can rotate it and move it around, and it's like shooting everywhere. It was like a game.
But that's not easy to do. Right? That is a very, how do I call it, a very a system that has to be very well balanced. Right? Every little component has to fit. And if one thing doesn't work, everything works.
Right.
Crashes.
Right.
So during Sintel, we made 2.5 workable. Right? There was almost every line of the core Blender code had to be rewritten for this.
Yeah.
In the whole core, there was, a million lines or something. They all had to be done, one by one. Everything was thrown away and recoded. And that was big. And I could do that thanks to, of course, at that time, we had more donations. I got some subsidies. The eShop was doing really well. We could sell DVDs. We sold in the end almost 6,000 DVDs with Sintel on it, the data files.
Really?
Yeah, and every DVD was €34.
It's quite a lot of money.
That's nice. You can do stuff with that.
Yeah.
So that helped us getting everything fixed and done. We could hire developers. And it was Brecht, of course, Brecht van Lommel. And we had Campbell, basically with the three of us, we were the core of the 2.5 team, and loads of great volunteers around it to make it possible.
Yeah.
And then we did, of course, Tears of Steel, with motion capture, motion tracking, masking, the whole visual effect pipeline, and the first project we used Cycles for. Cycles.
Oh, right, of course. Yeah.
Cycles popped up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah.
That was great.
What about Yo Frankie?
I missed that game that was in between. It was a bit before Sintel.
Right.
But Yo Frankie, I usually forget it a bit because it was not a complete success. It had mixed things a bit. Because I thought as an experiment, I was too optimistic, but I thought, let's do something, an open project with another open source community. So they do the game engine, and then we
Crystal Space?
Crystal Space.
And it didn't work?
Nah, it didn't work.
Yeah.
I was really spoiled with the quality of how the Blender community, at that time, they were already very professional, high-quality artists, good developers, and you can really sit together and say, okay, guys, we are going to, what are we going to do? And we already did that a couple of times for two movies. Mm-hmm. And I thought that for the game project, you could simply set a nice target and a big leap forward. And simply by doing it, by announcing it and putting some money in it and making awesome content, it will happen. That's the magic of open movies.
Yeah.
But for Crystal Space, that didn't work. So.
Can I ask, a lot of people wonder why the game engine part of Blender had a lot of attention on it.
No, because halfway the Yo Frankie, we switched from using Crystal Space to using Leonard Abramson. And it was mainly thanks to one developer. It was a guy from Belgium, Benoit. And he suddenly started fixing every day, like everything.
Right.
And later I heard that he's a daddy and he had his little kid playing with Blender and he wanted to make a game in Blender. Okay, sure, let's see. Yeah, it's a bug. I'm going to fix that. Ah, another bug. So he was simply working with his son, fixing Blender, to have his kid able to make a game. And meanwhile, we were working and struggling with this game project. And we thought, oh, the Blender game engine is way too unstable. Nobody can fix that. So we have to use Crystal Space. And suddenly, he started fixing everything.
Oh, I didn't know this. That's
so good. But those kind of things are hard to organize.
Yeah.
So how do you find, but he's a top software engineer. He's hired by big companies and stuff. I can't even afford him that. He's really good. He's working for medical simulations and that kind of things. He's good. He's still on board. He's doing sometimes things, but he's fantastic.
Yeah.
And he made it work. But then he had to do other stuff, and then we were stuck a little bit again.
Yeah. Right?
So yeah, why the game engine? I think the game engine's main problem is that the original design from 2000, in the Not a Number Company, we redesigned the game engine. A whole lot of design decisions were wrong. They were not good. So we had all kinds of assumptions about how to put it in Blender. Most of them didn't work out. And they didn't work out in a way that you would get a natural evolution of increasing quality in the software. Mm-hmm. And with Blender, a lot of those design decisions were very lucky. They were good. And if they were bad, you could fix it. But then you had an evolution, as you know, for Blender, where Blender kept improving and improving and improving. And it's like crazy. It's amazing how much improvement we could afford with a piece of software from 95, right?
Gosh, yeah.
So that's the good thing of Blender. And the Blender game engine, it's a pen, and it's mostly... one of the worst thing that the game engine didn't do well was that it completely duplicated the code. Right? So if any feature we add in Blender, you also have to do that again in the game engine. So you got two code bases for the same
right.
feature. Not everything, but for a lot.
Yeah.
Like, for example, if now you added Eevee in Blender, it's not in the game engine. You have to duplicate it again. So... And that's not, sounds simple, but it's not, because adding software is only stable if you keep working on it and looking at it, and there's hundreds of people online working on the bug tracker, reporting things, and really make that work. And so the amount of feedback people give on the Blender code and the Blender usability is way higher than the amount of feedback and energy that goes to the game engine. And the game engine, every time, they have to find time to copy the fixes and the code over. Right? So all the energy that went to Blender doesn't go to the game engine.
Yeah.
So if we would have designed a structure where, let's say, 90% of the game engine would be using the same code as Blender, then the game engine would have benefited from all the work on Blender itself. But yeah, and the maintenance of the game engine was much smaller. And that's my proposal for a new design for the 2.8 game engine, is to...
Yeah, tell me about the plan.
Yeah, we have to reuse much more. And I know it's not fun. The most game engine coders, you know game engine coders? There's a special type of people who do that. It's like render engine coders or ray tracer coders. Because you have something, and it's a piece of abstract stuff, it's a code thing, and you can completely control it. It's exciting, it's fun, right?
Yeah.
And then you can make it faster, or you can make it, you add some features, and it's a nice thing you can hold in your hand, as I do here. And you don't have to do a lot with other people, really, even better, right? It's great stuff for the computer coders, the nerds who don't like people a lot. They want to have technology to play with. Mm. And Blender is not like that. Blender is dirt and messy and complicated, and lots of other people are doing things. Yeah? He's doing something, and then something falls over. So that's the a different approach. So that's a for this game engine idea for 2.8 is to make sure that most of it will become part of the Blender project. So, for example, we have Eevee, and Eevee suddenly, everybody's making fantastic things with it. Animation is coming back in Eevee this week or next week.
Animation?
Animation, of course. Animation playback, real-time characters, all the stuff.
Oh, that isn't in there yet?
It's not yet, but now it's coming. All the modifiers, subdivision surfaces. It's going to be a very high-quality production engine. And it's real-time. So having that the game engine, oh, that would make things so easy for users. So you start modeling, you press P for the game engine, and everything is the same, and it's real time. You animate something, and you can do the same animation. It should be fluid.
Yeah. But maybe don't make it P. The number of times I hit that.
A foot pedal.
Yeah,
pedal.
Yes.
No, I hit the P key.
Or maybe Control-Shift-Alt-C.
Yeah, of course, five buttons. Or waving at your screen.
yeah, gestures. What's the plan with the interface for 2.8? Because there was a time a few years ago where I proposed a plan for a crazy interface. Wasn't that great of an idea?
Yeah.
But I got a lot of people thinking. What's happening with the?
What happened with your fantastic design? What happened with it? I mean,
in the recycling bin.
The design was not bad. Uh-huh. I mean, that's what we agreed on. It was not that you did something stupid, but the thing was mostly to keep it practical. You know, what we have Blender, and how do you get Blender to become better? How do you improve it? And that's a different task, a different design task than as making a new design for it. It was difficult to apply that. You say, okay, here's a design, and I'll let sense Blender to make it work for it.
Right, yeah.
So it should be more the opposite, because here you have Blender, and what is a better way to use it? So how can we improve it that it becomes easier to learn, or better configurable, all those other things.
Right.
And for 2.5, we tackled a couple of topics.
Yeah.
But we left a lot, and that's why I decided let's do a 2.8, which has similar ambition, really big things, and make sure the Blender is ready for the next decade.
Decade? Oh.
Yeah, of course.
Oh.
It's almost 2020.
I know, right?
It goes really fast.
Yeah, Blender's got to keep with the times.
Yeah. So we have to, because 2.5, the whole design process and everything. We started 10 years ago, almost.
Gosh.
And then we were finished in 2010. So now, last year, we started at 2.8, and that will be 2018, right?
Yeah, so it's going to be finished at the start of 2018?
Yeah, I hope, if everything works
out. If you had to put money on it, what day would it release?
Yeah, with the money. I think the planning is to get a beta version in March, April.
Okay.
Something.
Right.
Good work.
So maybe June.
By the end of or at the conference, Blender in October next year, we could have the first official release.
Ooh.
Or maybe at SIGGRAPH in Vancouver. But I want to hurry up. People have to be, we also need to be practical. We can't do everything. Right? So we have to depend on really good people who know how to code things. Anyway, so what is wrong with the Blender interface? Well, there's a couple of things. A lot of people, you don't have to like every UI. I mean, people have their own preferences and other way of working, or sometimes they are used to work with a specific tool, and they like Blender to do the same. The other problem is that what we tried with the UI was to make one configuration work for everyone.
You tried?
Yeah, everybody in the community tried. And that's your P key problem, right? You hit it all the time. It's stupid, right? And at some moment we added, for the animators, that the up arrow would not advance 10 frames anymore, but it would go to the next keyframe. I hated that. I was used to quickly with up arrow to go to steps of 10 through my animation.
So they did change it. I thought something happened.
Control up. That was just the developers decided. Right? I'm not deciding everything. But so you get different types of users, and they have different types of interaction. They have different shortcuts or tools they think are more important. So we decided to, instead of having one configuration for everyone, we should allow Blender to be configured for different types of workflow. An animator, they is not so interested in having the game engine, the motion tracker, all the stuff. You can remove easily half of the shortcuts, which is not interesting for animation. All the stuff that is useful maybe for modeling or for physics and particle systems, all that stuff, or modifiers. Animators can configure the software for them to be fast, with all the arrow keys and the clicks doing exactly what they want. For a modeler or a sculptor or 3D painter or a video editor or motion tracker, you can basically have the same. And they say, okay, I'm motion tracking this shot or this film. I have to work for 2 or 3 weeks only on motion tracking. I want my tool to help me to do my work faster and more efficient and less mouse strain or whatever. I thought that I can configure that. So that's meant for the power users, the hardcore users. But what I added to that was, so let's also then try to make a configuration for more occasional users. Not everybody is working on 3D professionally, but there are a lot of people who say, yeah, but sometimes I want to do something in 3D. I want to make a 3D print, or I have a 3D scan, or I want to retopo it and print it out, or I want to have a little model for an AR application, because 3D is now mainstream. Right? It's, 3D is part of your education nowadays. Everybody should understand it a bit.
You think?
Yeah, it's coming. In Canada, high school kids have to do 3D classes.
Really?
Yeah.
They have to?
Yeah.
Mandatory.
Part of their curriculum. Autodesk one, a bit. We try to get Blender in the high schools, but Autodesk one.
The story of Blender.
We don't have enough money to bribe the right people, I think. Right?
Yeah.
So,
what do you think of Autodesk?
What do I think of Autodesk?
Yeah, yeah, because I know
they are my best friends. So what, I usually try to meet Autodesk people in SIGGRAPH in Los Angeles or elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But this year I was too busy and didn't have time. But last year I had a couple of meetings.
So you meet Autodesk people at SIGGRAPH. How does it go? Do they ever go like, you said on Twitter?
They're going to sue you. They're nice. So once I had, the last year I saw the head of Arnold. They were bought by Autodesk.
Okay.
And talking to them about things because they wanted to get Arnold also in Blender. How do we work with that? Problems, licenses, stuff like that. And I had a meeting with guys about FBX. Because FBX is the standard, right? For a lot of artists to move animation data from one application to the other. Especially in the games industry. Everybody's using FBX. But it's a locked-in format. And Autodesk is frustrating everybody who tries to reverse engineer it by changing the format every year. Just for fun.
Wait, who is?
Autodesk.
They are?
It's a strategy, yeah. They simply obscure things and they make things to make sure that everybody who has their own FBX thing, for writer, reader, every year you have to update things and fix it.
Oh, no.
No, that's not fun, right?
What did you tell them?
Yeah, I told them that. I said, there's technical reasons for that, blah, blah, blah. They don't really admit this.
Financial
but
reasons.
But I said, yeah, but you have to, what would be better if you say we are going to do something for open source or for our users, then make sure that interoperability between Autodesk products and other products, that is smoother. If the industry works together, that's a win-win situation. And they listened, and they said they would come back to that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really push this. Mm-hmm. But I never heard back. And I think internally, Autodesk is, of course, They have their own policy. It's a $2 billion company.
Is it $2
billion? $2 billion every year of revenue. So they are worth 10 or so, I don't know. It's not a small business.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's big. And they're on the stock market, so they're publicly traded. So they're not so easy. I'm myself. I can decide every day what I want to do. But they have a job. And they have a boss, and then a vice president, and then a senior vice president, and then a director. And right? But that's how big companies go. So those things are not so simple.
Right.
Well, but further, Autodesk is, of course, a company with a, I think, with a philosophy that they want to lock in the users in their own world. And so whatever is possible with 3D, Autodesk should give them the full package. And if they don't have something, they buy it.
They what?
They buy it.
Oh.
Right? You know, I know it, most of the tools, from Maya to 3D Max to Arnold to Flame, remember it, they're all bought. They didn't make it. They buy them. And then they stamp it with Autodesk. And that's how they can create an infrastructure where everything is happy and beautiful and everything works together, but not if you use one of the competitor tools. Of course, that's how capitalism works, right? I mean, you can't complain about that.
Yeah.
I don't blame them. It's
Who's making the Open Olympics system?
Olympic, I think it's ILM or...
Ah.
I think it's ILM.
And they also did OpenEXR, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're more into the open...
Oh, yeah. The film industry is totally into it.
Yeah.
Because
They must hate this FBX every year thing.
But they use Maya, so they don't have a problem with that.
Oh.
So we hate it, especially.
Yeah, I bet.
So.
Can you make it reverse? Like, can you make a FBX that's proprietary work with Blender? Is that legally...
What some people wanted us to do is to get the FBX library from Autodesk and put that in Blender. That's the official way how all other applications do it as well. And then you get the Autodesk code, and you link it with Blender, and then we have FBX in and out. But the Autodesk license doesn't allow that to combine it with open source. Or for some people, the other way around, the Blender license doesn't allow to use the FBX library. They're completely different worlds. Mm. And for example, if you would do that, then we're not allowed to bundle it, but then if you start Blender, then you have to go to the Autodesk website and register there and then download that component. Or we have to do that on our website and give Autodesk all the information from every user who downloaded Blender.
Hmm.
That's in their license.
Really?
So any program who has an agreement with Autodesk to use FBX is following that guideline. They give all the privacy and all the personal information to Autodesk.
Oh, and that's why you wrote that post. Yeah.
Nobody reads those licenses.
And this one is quite bad, isn't it?
It's horrible.
Yeah, it's not.
They can visit you at home if you use Autodesk and check your computer was on it.
That's a good quote.
Some people ask me, hey, Tom, if I use Blender, the art I make, is that my property? Can I do whatever I like with it? Of course. That's open the Free Software Foundation philosophy, right? We are making free software. Do whatever you do with the content. Autodesk, on the other hand, they also have educational versions. In the license, it says that everything you make with educational software is not your property. You cannot do whatever you like with it. It is restricted. You can only do a little bit with it, but you cannot do other things with it. So basically, Autodesk controls the content for that.
Oh.
Especially for commercial use or use inside of companies or if you want to sell something. So you can only use it to learn the software, but not to do anything with the content.
And then
they complain about Blender having an evil license. But of course, everybody
ignores. Wait, who says that? Who says that?
Like that kind of emails. It gets less, but even today, at a business meeting with a studio, and they say, yeah, we are thinking about Blender, but the license, you know. And then if we start using Blender, then we might get sued or have patent problems.
By who?
And is the content ours if we use Blender? Is it really ours? Because we got free software? Maybe the content is then yours. I said, no. I do hear rumors that Autodesk is spreading that story.
What?
Yeah. Autodesk.
That's a conspiracy,
they
Tom.
Go to companies and say, I don't use Blender, but you know, open source, the content you make has to be open too, so you have to share it or everything. They spread those rumors.
That's...
So shame on you. Autodesk.
That's... Well, allegedly, or not even allegedly, rumored, we should say. Yes,
I heard.
You heard from...
I heard it. But I heard it from people... Who heard it from Autodesk?
Okay.
So it's only one in between, right? It's a witness, right? It's like you could tell me, and then I have to believe you. Right?
Yes, yes.
So yeah, I met especially studios in Europe, but also Australia or Indonesia. They get visitors from Autodesk, and if they say, "Ah, we are using Blender," then especially they get visitors from Autodesk. Knock, knock. Hey, I'm your Autodesk sales representative. I see you're using Blender. I have something much better. Let's talk. Maybe we can give you nice discounts or things so to make sure that you are kicking Blender out.
Whoa,
that
sounds
really
very...
Happens.
Really?
Yeah.
Sounds very 1984.
It's normal business. Why is that nasty? They make money with it. It's what they have to do. I don't make money with it, so I don't care. If they want to use Maya, they should use Maya.
Yeah.
Right?
So you believe that the product should speak for itself, right? Like if it's better, you use the better one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody should decide that for themselves. I think that's a bit of a difference between the Blender, how Blender is in the open source world. Some people use open source software out of principle. GIMP or Inkscape or open source video editors. They want to live in an open world. They use Linux and they only use the open drivers and they make sure that their whole system only uses open source. Mm-hmm. And for them, Blender is of course fantastic because then they have an open tool to do things. But that might be, I don't know, 1% of the users maybe. There's a tiny fraction of the people use Blender out of principle. Most people use Blender because it's fun, or because they like it, or because it's a fun community, or because of the freedom. Yeah, you can have it legally. You don't have to worry about evil corporations visiting you, or simply because it's good enough for them.
Yeah,
they like it. I mean, you know that.
Of course.
Why do people come to the Blender Guru site to buy stuff? Because they want to have fun, or they're interested to develop skills, or they want to know how to make real glass. And then they model a city fun house, right? But, and then with one button, they can make it look awesome.
Yeah.
Right? And that's fun.
Yeah.
And that's stuff people like. It's playing with 3D, learning from it. And next time you make a better house, or you got a training how to make good architecture, how to make the light for that. And people like to develop those kind of skills.
Yeah.
And I think Blender is more than good enough for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's at the same level as Maya or Max.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or even better, I don't think Maya or Max would ever make that possible, like what you do.
You know what's funny? Very early on, I was, after I started Blender Guru, I thought, maybe Blender's not the best for the future. Like, I don't know, it seems like 3D's Max could be bigger. Yeah, so what I did was I emailed Autodesk and I said, hey, just want to check legally, am I able to have a tutorial website? I'll call it 3D's Max Guru, whatever. And I make tutorials about your software. And they couldn't give a straight answer. They didn't know. They said, well, we would have to get back to you. We have to check with the legal team kind of thing. And I thought, forget it.
Max Guru or so would not be approved.
Yeah, I know. So it's like they don't want tutorials for their... I don't know. Maybe it was just the person I spoke with.
Yeah, but it's a locked-in system.
Yeah.
So there are not many Max users, legal ones, or legal Maya users.
That's true.
Most of them have the student version, or they have the
free
version.
I know.
And that's a bit of a problem. That's why what I said. So thanks to Blender, you can do this, and the cookies and others, they can do things, because the users can get the software, they can get it for free. It's an interesting product. It's not an evil corporation behind it. And then they build a relationship with you. Because you do something, you add value to the product, and that's what people like. And that's what people like. Other people who make Blender products as well.
Yeah.
And if you would do this for Maya, then you would get a completely different thing, because the first step for them is they'll have to buy Maya, or you have to buy Modo, or you have to buy any other product. And that's a big investment.
It is, yeah.
It's really, why would they pay $3,000 per year for the software and then have for fun, right?
Yeah.
Or for training yourself or doing something?
It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a huge amount. I was thinking that, like, I didn't realize how much more expensive it is. Like, I use Adobe Creative Cloud, the subscription, and it's $600 per year. But you get Premiere, Photoshop, After Effects, Audition, InDesign. You get like 20 pieces of software, $600 a year. And then we were looking at for Polygon, like purchasing 3ds Max so we could make tutorials. It's $3,000. And then you want to do one for Maya, another $3,000 per year. And I was like, blows my mind. I don't know how they get away with that. That's crazy. Doesn't make any sense to me.
No. Well, it's because they don't sell that many.
Yeah? You think it's still quite niche?
I mean, the 3D market is small.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you could look it up. I wrote that. Remember you said you saw that on the wiki? So I went to the public report from Autodesk and look at, how much money do they make? Okay, $2 billion per year. And then you get more information and see, okay, the whole of the media, the digital media department of Autodesk, that's where Mudbox, Arno, Maya, 3D Max, and all those tools are, has $100 million revenues per year. Now, $100 million, that sounds fantastic, but it's all of them.
Yeah, that's not a lot, is it?
Imagine half of that is 3D Max. That's $50 million. Max costs $3,000-$4,000 per year. Now, you divide that, $50 million divided by 4,000.
I don't know what that is.
That's
calculator.
12,000 licenses.
Is it?
What? Ten? Who's calculating it?
12,500.
Yeah.
That's quite...
That's nothing. So
that's an alarming...
Yeah, sure. Maybe it's 25,000 or 30,000.
You get more downloads than that in a month, right? Blender gets more downloads than that in a month.
Yeah, so most there probably is 1 million downloads every year or so for Max or for Maya at the Autodesk website, at the formal training and the student versions. But the paying user base is not that big.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that amount of money, they can't have a lot of people developing. So there's maybe 10, 20 Maya developers. And they have a group in China now, in the Chinese factory.
Wait, there's only 10 or 20 developers?
Hmm?
There's only 20 developers?
No, 10 or 20 something.
For 3ds Max or Maya?
For Maya. Max is bigger, but Maya is not that big.
I would have thought there'd be like hundreds.
But how do they pay them? There's not enough money for it.
It's like $100 million.
But Maya is maybe 1/10 of the size of 3D Max.
Is it?
Or maybe 20%. Come on, how big is it?
I don't know.
You have 100 million, you have to divide it, right?
Yeah.
There's stuff going to Mudbox, there's stuff going to the compositing software, and the stuff, right? So what is 10% is Maya? 20%? It's nothing.
It's not a lot, is it?
You can get 20 people or so, 30 people. And of course, you have to pay all the sales people and the marketing people and the key in lock installators. And you have to pay the resellers. People resell the software, they get a percentage. And then you have very expensive boots at SIGGRAPH. And you add up all those things. So, and then there's a little bit left for the developers.
Where did you get that 100 million figure from? Where's that from?
You can find it online.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I tried to find it. I couldn't find anything.
So, you have to find better, man.
I know. Maybe I was typing in users, and I couldn't find actual user statistics.
No, of course not. What you have to ask for is annual report Autodesk.
Right, financial reports. Yeah.
And that's the official report they have to deposit. Because they are public traded companies.
Shareholders, yeah.
Every public traded company has to publish the numbers. And then you start digging. Yeah, it's boring. It's whatever. Yeah, 100 pages of stuff. And then you see some numbers. It's like, aha.
Yeah.
Media and the media and entertainment division, that's what it's called officially, is 5% of the revenue of all of Autodesk. I said, that's the number they said. So, okay, let's see, the total is 2 billion times 5%.
Yeah.
100 million. What did you do in high school?
I did not do a lot.
So I'm good in the numbers. As a coder, you have to be able to define brain. So,
no, that's the one thing I like about Blender, is you can do the math in
I type it in Google. 150 times 20.
Yeah, I do that. No.
Anyway, so that's how you start. And I say, okay, so that's 100 million. That's the size of the media and entertainment group. Now, what can I find more? So how much this and that, how many? And I say, that's not a lot of money. Most of the money they are making with, not with AutoCAD even, most of the money they make with visualization. Visualization.
What do you mean?
The car industry, architecture companies. So there's a lot of technical visualization going on in the world, and it's very specialist. Oil industry, industry, right?
Yeah.
The stuff. I'm in the happy 3D art and games world where only smiling people walk around. But there's a whole world of factories and companies, and there are engineers sitting behind workstation doing boring things like floor plans and things and pipes. That's how you build a house or a car or what. And that industry is way, way bigger than the whole film industry and the games industry together.
Is it?
Of course.
I would have never guessed that. I thought they...
What do you think? How do you make a car? I haven't looked at it. I think you spend
but I don't know how many
way more money on making a car than making a movie.
Really?
Otherwise, watching a movie only is $10. Buying a car will cost you $50,000.
Well, that's a good point. I was thinking profit.
And you know how many people have a car?
It's a lot.
Well, how do you make them?
It's a good question.
And they all cost 20,000-30,000 each.
Yeah.
Try to do the math.
Yeah.
Those companies are way bigger.
Well, when you say it like that.
That's,
But I was just thinking, like, the movie industry, they say is like one of the most profitable industries, right? Because of how...
Nah.
Even the duds, the movies that do terribly critically, they still, making 80 million profit or whatever. It's not unusual. So I thought, it's huge.
That's why Disney buys everything. Disney bought Pixar, they bought Lucas, they bought...
Wait, Disney didn't buy Pixar, did they?
Yeah. Disney bought Pixar.
Aren't they in it's an agreement, isn't it? It's a partnership.
Disney was way bigger than Pixar. Way. They have so much.
Oh, I know if Disney's
TV
bigger.
And parks and...
Of course, yeah. But so, I don't know if they bought Pixar. I don't think that's true.
They bought Pixar.
Is it?
If you go to a Pixar movie, you get first the Disney logo.
Yeah, but it was a
merger, you thought.
It's an agreement. Didn't you read that Creativity Inc. book?
Ask Google. Disney bought Pixar? Question mark.
Google it.
And it will tell you.
See, the problem is we put this out there and then the information is wrong. Then 100% of the comments are, Andrew, you're wrong. Pixar is owned by Disney. So we have to figure this out before.
Always ask Google first.
Yeah, I know. Soon we'll just be Echo in the corner.
I got it.
Okay.
Acquisition by Disney. Disney announced on January 24, 2006 that it agreed to buy Pixar for approximately $7.4 billion in an all-out stock deal. Following Pixar shareholder approval, the acquisition was completed May 5, 2006 from the Pixar Wiki. If we trust that.
And do you know, who made the most money with that?
Ed
Catmull? Steve Jobs.
What?
Steve Jobs. Apple.
Yeah, that's
he made
true.
All the money, but he owned most of Pixar.
Yeah.
And well, where's that money now?
He fronted the money, of course. What do you mean?
Where's the money? Somewhere here in L.A., there's the daughter of the kids of Steve.
Yeah.
Or whatever the Bay Area. And they have 10, 20, whatever, billion on the bank.
That's the sort of thing that makes you think, like, late at night, and you're like, there's people out there with billions. Where are they right now? Flying around.
Getting depressed.
Eating $100 million sushi.
There is no normal person you can talk to. If you're walking around, I have 10 billion on the bank, and then you think, oh my God, you can make everything possible. You can go to Mars, or you can make your own car company, or buy everything you want. Yeah. After a while, that shit is deadly boring.
Yeah.
And then nobody talks to you in a normal way.
Yeah, that's true. I have heard,
and then
like,
you have to lock yourself up and talk only with other billionaires.
Yeah.
Oh, how fun is that?
I've heard, like, no, you shouldn't ever want to be a billionaire, because what you can do with $1 billion is almost the same thing you can do with 10 million. But when you're a billionaire, the amount of attention you get makes your life unbearable. So it's better to be a lot smaller, you know. Not that it's a possibility for me, but...
They're still thinking about it.
Yeah, this doesn't pay for itself. You know what I'm saying? What do you think is... what do you think stopping Blender from becoming the predominant software in the industry? Like, you could be able to walk down to Disney or another studio, and everybody there is using Blender. How come they're not?
But what is the dominant software? I mean...
3D's Max on Maya.
But not if you walk into Disney. They don't use Max.
Well, they have their own thing,
They have their own things. So the smaller ones, the smaller studios at 20 to 50 people, that size, right? And if they are VFX, so it's of course all Nuke. Nuke is fantastic for things. But for modeling and for 3D, Blender, you can see more often popping up already.
In small studios.
But I don't think it's something that stops. I think it's a gradual evolution, because it happens now, little bit by little bit, more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there is a whole VFX studio in LA only using Blender for their 3D stuff.
Barnstorm, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm visiting them on Friday. It should be fun.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
And it's insane. You see people using Blender, they're not complaining or so. They don't make a problem. They just click around and do their stuff.
Yeah.
It's a job.
Yeah.
And they do awesome things. Good artists. Good software.
I know.
And good products.
Is it just me? It feels like Blender, very recently, the last 2 or 3 years, has reached, like, I don't know, the graph of, like, adoption seems to be going, like, exponentially more. Like, back in 2009, it was, like, very fringe group. Like, if you mentioned to somebody that you use Blender and they're a 3D artist, a lot of people hadn't even heard of it. Whereas now, if you say Blender, like...
But after 2.5 and Cintel, that was the first leap.
That was a leap.
That suddenly it was amateur, fun, hobby.
Yeah.
And suddenly, hey, this might be possible in production. Right?
Yeah.
And for me, another big, big milestone was Sigraph 2013 or 14, when Pixar announced to support Blender with RenderMan. So they have the RenderMan plugin, and they only do that for... four programs. So they have RenderMan for Maya, RenderMan for Houdini, RenderMan for... I forgot.
Max?
And Blender. No, Max.
Really? No way.
Houdini, Maya, Blender, and I forgot something.
That's where I've noticed it, is when you go to the third parties in the industry and you visit their website, like in the old days, if you look at like software supported, Blender was never on there. But now, it's there. And it's quite, I'm like, ooh, like Evermotion, they started releasing some model packs now for Blender. And it's like, it's quite, but that's, things are changing.
But is that a purpose strategy, in a sense, right? I think the best thing of what we do with open source is to keep it very feasible, simple, and stable. So we don't do risky stuff. If you would be a company, you know that you run a business. You suddenly have employees and people working, and then you suddenly look at your monthly expense and say, oh my God, shit, every month tens of thousands or 50,000 is going out. How am I going to pay everybody? I have to keep the company running and stuff. Now, but that happens for cinema or the others. They have to make 10, 20 million per year.
Right.
That means every month they have to pay 1 million in costs only. Every month!
Yeah, it's
so
quite...
What happens if suddenly they have like 100 less users or so, or 200, and so, my God, they have to fire people, and they get that whole stress. So a lot of the focus on the business is not so much on the product development. And in Blender, I always try to have all of the focus on the product software. The users, the bug fixing, keeping it stable, make sure that things are working, make sure that we are not going into 20 different directions, finding the right people to help contributing, and setting a very gradable path, and make sure that every step is always supported and feasible. And that's you can only do it if you do it more slow. Mm. And otherwise, things would break.
Mm.
And once in a while, you do a leap. That's for 2.5, we did a leap. And officially, in open source circles, doing those kind of leaps are always failures. So no open source project is advised to ever do a leap. Always do things gradually.
Really?
Yeah. So Blender survived one leap. It's unique. It's really unique.
Is it going to survive the next leap?
We will find out next year. Yes. I think so. Blender 2.8 is going fantastic.
I think so.
It's going fantastic. And Eevee then you saw it on SIGGRAPH. Oh, you were not there, but SIGGRAPH, you had Eevee. Yeah. And Eevee is like, for my God, it's really, it's not only real time, it's Blender itself, it's the tool. You click on things, you move things around, you press tab, it's edit mode, it's this, you can paint on it, you can move the lights around, it looks photorealistic and it's real time. Right, finally, it's so good.
I know.
And then we didn't even start. There's so many other really good features coming in 2.8, the dependency graph, multi-threaded, duplication, massive stuff, way more complicated scenes that stay interactive, multiple times in windows, that one window playing Blender in animation, the other you can pose the character and you can see real-time updates, that kind of stuff. And of course, the 101, what I said, we are going to make a version of Blender which is reduced. And we can remove 95% of the features and really try to configure things with nice, simple, big buttons. And then make, for example, the first prototype we want to make, a tool for people who use 3D printers. So you want to have a model,
you
want to clean it a little bit, I want to see the size, and then you send it to the printer for print.
I'm quite skeptical of 1.1 because I heard an analogy. Tell me what you think about this. But they say you shouldn't ever simplify the software if the plan is to get them to use the original. Because if you want to teach someone how to drive a car, you don't first of all give them a car with just a steering wheel and no pedals, because then in the future they're going to be struggling with all the different things.
Kids. I've seen those toys with all the steering wheels. So that's why it's so difficult to use pedals down there. Maybe the analogy is not really the best, but I know what you mean. How can you decomplexify something in a useful way without taking away what it makes powerful? But I think for Blender, we can do it now, because if you look back from 2002 all the way 15 years later, the amount of stuff we added to Blender is insane. Even though it looks very great with all the markers and stuff, but the amount of features and things Blender can do is really, really insane. It's getting out of control. So even when we want, we can't continue that way. There is no space in the UI. There is no space for the shortcuts. We can't handle it. Mm-hmm. We have to do something to reduce it, to specialize. That's what I said. Because as a sculptor or a modeler, you want to have advanced tools, but you don't need to see all the other stuff from the game people and the motion tracking people and the lighting and texturing people. Right? So you can reduce from that 100%, you can go back to 30 or 20 and then optimize that. But every feature what you have left is still advanced. So it's not that you make it less good to sculpt. Of course not. Sculpting stays fantastic. But you don't have all the other stuff on the way. And so for 3D printing, it can still be, I mean, you can have sculpting in it for 3D print. It's very nice to sculpt on to do for 3D printing. And from base and the modeler can be there. And that's it. And you make a nice bigger toolbar with bigger icons so you have people can find the basic tools better. So that's what you can do in 101 or in 2.8. You can configure your UI entirely. And you can make a version with only 10 materials, 10 models, and then you drag a model in the window where you see a monkey, and then you add the blue material on top of it and you have a blue monkey. And further, Blender wouldn't do anything. That's possible. That's my challenge for the coders. Is that useful? I don't know. But I want to try, right? Because that's, did you read it? We have what we call the application template. It's a new concept in Blender. It's a template that also becomes an application. So there's a Blend file that has the configuration of Blender. And then if you load that, you can get a complete different software, almost.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
I want to see how that works. And it's an experiment. You only know...
That's right, I agree.
You have to do it to fail, right? Yeah. It'll be a success.
You know what would be another cool experiment? If we made the left mouse click the default.
Oh, yeah. But that's already discussed a year ago. And that whole
Can you tell me what was the... outcome?
The whole thing for how do you want to configure Blender is going to get an overhaul. So if you start Blender for the first time, you can get a very quick little questionnaire. That's just a button that says, well, I'm a power user. I want to use the previous settings. Click, you get the old settings. Or say, I'm a new user. And I want to learn Blender and I want to have the settings, one or two options. And that's how you can start. And for the new users, you should follow all the conventions. That's fine. But if you say, no, I want to learn the tutorials from Blender.org, then you can get a configuration.
That's going to make my job quite hard.
But in principle, you could make your own application template.
Yeah.
On your website and say, here, download Blender, but get my template, and then Blender becomes your Blender.
I don't know about that. I went to the ZBrush Summit, and they were saying, like, because I tried learning ZBrush a little while ago, and it blew my mind just how poorly the interface was. And it's like, it's
looks so fun and stuff. The screenshots and all
that stuff. Oh, yeah, it's very, it works just like real clay. It works just like real clay. But it's more complex than it needs to be. And, everyone I spoke to at ZBrush is they say, yeah, but the default one is very tricky, but once you learn it for 5 to 10 years, you can make your custom interface. And I said,
10 years.
That's the problem with ZBrush, is that they haven't got a good default software. I think the software at default is important.
There's an interface team. And I said before, you're welcome to join. Jonathan is there and a couple of others. And they will make sure that we have a number of defaults. You cannot only have one, because everybody is using computers in a different way. For example, with pen and tablet, you don't have a left or right mouse, you only have a click and a hold click. And for them, you should be able to have within one click after you start Blender to make Blender working for that. And that is similar to how you want to use Blender only with left click. Because people only want to use left clicks and no right clicks, but not for selecting. You should have that configuration work from start and very well designed. But that doesn't mean that the concept of assigning selecting to a different mouse button is not bad or good. I think it's really good.
Yeah.
And it saves you from mouse strain, especially if you use a little bit more fingers.
Yeah.
If you only use one, I can't use this anymore. I have to switch mouse to left.
Yeah, but it's the convention.
Yeah.
It's what everybody knows.
Yeah, you know. That's right. Yeah. And especially for new users, left mouse select is very more convenient.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the main problem is not so much the default. The main problem is that people don't know how to find the default. And it is that the left click is still not as good as the right click. Because not everything works optimal if you configure it. And that's what we have to solve.
Yeah. I think it could be solved more easier than it sounds, though. Like, I remember Sebastian made a video explaining why the right click was better.
Superior,
and
totally superior.
But everything that he mentioned could be solved just by holding down control. You know? Like, it doesn't have to be right or left. It's like, make it left, but if you want to select that other thing, it's control left. I don't know, I feel like it's not.
And for we have tablets nowadays, and pads, and for those things. We have to look at, well, where does it go to? How long are we keep using a mouse?
Yeah.
You use a tablet yourself?
Yeah.
Sometimes?
Yeah.
With Blender? No.
For sculpting, yeah.
Okay, but I think the tablets are very nice interfaces, and that's what we have to make work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course, we work on it.
Yeah. So I'm allowed to contribute to the interface?
Of course.
I thought I was expelled from the discussions.
Make mock-ups, come with designs, ideas, see what other people are doing.
Yeah.
Of course.
There's a lot of politics in interface, isn't it?
Nah.
No?
Nah. Okay, what is politics? I mean, the politics part is that you should collaborate and look at what other people are doing and not trying to push one thing at the truth. If you start having discussions on that level, if people say, yeah, but everybody or the market standard is, and that's why we... That's always confusing discussions, because people never agree on those things. So what you can better look at is, okay, so how can we create the optimal workflow for Blender users? So how does it work? What are the things to make sure that the experience is optimal, that they can work fast, and that you have a good ergonomic workflow? Those kind of discussions are more useful. If you agree on that level, then you can say, okay, we have a nice design, but it is not standard. So that means the people have to learn it. And not everybody likes to do that. Some people say, I don't want to learn anything new. I want to copy what I know from Maya or Max or another program. And I want Blender to reward that behavior. Right? Mm-hmm. But I do Alt-click for viewport rotate in Maya. And that has grown on to me, and I want to keep using that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's what 2.8 is meant to do, to make sure that those kind of configurations are advanced and stable and keep working.
Yeah.
And then the whole discussions about the default is not so interesting anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's more like, okay, which of the defaults are you using? Yeah, I'm using the cookie default. Oh, but I use the Guru default. Way more fun. Maybe it goes that way. But one default is good. Of course, we should have a minimum, the minimum configuration. That's what I think. What I like about Maya, for example, if you install it, we did it once to the educational version, and the default key map in Maya is minimal. It hardly has anything configured, especially shortcuts. Everything works based on using menus. If you see Maya tutorials, it's often that you see people click, click, and then they have a tool, do something, click, menu, click, 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 click. And that's a bit slow, but it's a good mode to learn things. Because you first have to learn how to navigate in the software. So where are all the options? Where is this? Where is the editing? Where are the vertices properties? Where are they? Right? And if you reveal that with shortcuts, the other little icons and stuff, then you forgot. Because you cannot remember 1,000 icons. You can only remember a few.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work, icons. But those lists and menus, they are quite well to navigate. If you keep them, and you know, okay, but the file thing, import, everybody knows that. You see it once, and you can find it again. Edit, view, right? We have a couple of standard concepts. And you know, okay, I want to set the view to camera, the view, camera, right? That's the navigation thing they present. I think that's what we will try for the 2.8 default. Or the one of the defaults to make sure that there are maybe 20, 30, 50 shortcuts. That's it. And for the rest, use the menus, use the buttons.
The thing that I'm most like worried about is like that the UI team is made up of power users, right? Like most of them have been using Blender for 10 years or so. And so therefore, it's you know, it's human nature to lean towards what you're most used to. And most Blender users are used to conventions which aren't in any other software. And so I wonder, like, if...
But most Blender users are Blender users.
That old thing again.
I know. So half of the Blender users use Blender already for more than a year, or two or three.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm more talking about new people. New
yes,
users.
Beginners. So I wonder who has the voice of the beginners.
I have a problem.
So who has the voice of the
beginner?
You
can't make a beginner who never used 3D software before, you put them in charge of designing interfaces.
Yeah, but they know that left click is select.
How do they know? They don't know nothing.
Because Windows, Microsoft, Mac, it's a convention.
They click about a button if it works.
A what?
I'm not going to argue with you with the left or the right click. I'm fine with left click select. But I'm not going to give up on the right click. But it's an option, right? You have to give people the option to configure things. And we want to present that. You can say, well, here is the training wheels Blender to get on board and learn things quick. You can use this configuration, the default for new people. And there are a number of configurations for the power users and people who use Blender already for longer.
Yeah.
And they want to type and work really fast, and they don't mind having a P that runs a game engine. Probably not.
Yeah.
So, and how much time? Yeah, I mean, about the politics in the group of contributors. I mean, there is a level of politics, and that's of course me, right? I'm the boss.
The head man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the benevolent dictator for life, BFDL. So, because I started this whole thing, and I have a couple of credits on board still, because I made it happen, and I maintain it, and I prove that I'm not always wrong, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm often right. I have a good sense of keeping things rock.
Yeah, yeah.
So, that gives me some credit. And I think it's good for a online community, for people who are involved with Blender, that they know that there's one person who can decide, and who's consistent and relatively predictable, and who's on board for the continuity and not for making himself more wealthy or, right? Because Blender and me, we are one, right? This is my life. I did this. It's the biggest thing I ever did, and I don't think I'll do everything.
It'll be your legacy.
Bigger.
Yeah, that's your legacy.
It's important. So I'm conservative in that sense. And even though you say that politics, if you don't agree with Tom, you got a problem. Yeah, that's true, right? But if you work for Apple and you don't agree with the company, then what do you want, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not too difficult to disagree with me. Some aspects I'm strong, and I say, well, this is what we keep, modality, a cutting blender and small windows and having them pop up with requesters. I had to fight over that forever. Now everybody says this is the right decision. But 15 years ago, it was a discussion topic, right? Mm-hmm. Or the file format. Blender is saving blend files and loading it. I mean, you know from other programs that saving and loading, that can take a while, right? And blend files are not as fast. Mm. But I had to fight for that, really. So that you can have a 1 second load of complete project is an important feature. But for most software developers, it's not. They want to have XML, and you get like Maya files, and then a big project in Maya would take 1 or 2 minutes to open.
Yeah.
So it's fun, right?
Yeah.
But for that kind of things, you can discuss that. Yeah. And we had those discussions, very heated, big discussions on changing the file format to make it more accessible for everyone, to make XML, because the whole industry is doing it. And I said no, right?
Right. So that's why it's sometimes so fast for Blender.
Yeah. And also, I have a couple of principles. So like that Blender should not have an installation requirement. So you can still have Blender for Windows on a sticky, mm-hmm. put it in your laptop, anyone's computer, and you start it and it will run. That's important.
Yeah.
It means that we will not change somebody's computer and that we can keep it local and work. And that it works cross-platform. There's a lot of benefits for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And Blender should start within a second.
Yeah.
It gets a bit slower nowadays, but you'll have to bring it back. That's important. You should not wait. Why would you wait for software?
Yeah. I'm amazed at how slow, a lot of software is to boot. Photoshop.
But I mean that those kind of political things, if you want to talk to me about making Blender's file format XML, then I'm a bit tired of that. That kind of topics is past, right? We don't go over that. The left mouse and right mouse discussion, we can laugh about that, right? Because I like to work with people who say, okay, I can see economical reasons to do this, and I think it's a fast workflow. But it's a bottleneck for new people to come on board.
Mm-hmm.
What? No, you think that's right?
Yeah.
No, then we have a deal.
Yeah.
So how complicated is that?
Yeah.
But some people say, this is the most stupid thing on the planet, and you are idiots, then it doesn't work. Right? So we talk to each other on a normal level, and then it doesn't matter if you are a power user or a new user.
Mm-hmm.
I would also welcome a software developer on board who is specialized in UI and usability, working on the Blender interface.
Is there anyone that's been in contact with you?
Not enough.
Yeah.
I think for 2.5 we had, for example, Matt Epp from Australia, William Reinisch. They were good guys.
Yeah. Is Matt Epp still work with Blender?
No, not anymore. He's doing Houdini. The Lego movies, for example.
That's why I haven't heard.
But William is sometimes available, and he might come back to do things.
Yeah.
But he did a good job on 2.5, and I want to make sure that we have a high quality UI.
Yeah.
But the others are not sitting still, even though Autodesk is not very innovative. But you get small companies doing new stuff, certainly like the Foundry, Anouk, and Modo, and others. But you also have Algorithmic, Substance Painter, Substance Designer. They're good tools. You use them.
Yeah.
And they're nice designed, I think.
Yeah.
They're well done.
But not as good as Blender's node groups.
No?
No.
What do you mean?
In Substance Designer, if you create this complex, crazy texture sort of system, and then you need to duplicate a part of it, like you want to take this setup with these 10 nodes.
And reuse it?
And you want to reuse it, there's no way to link duplicate it. Whereas Blender, you create a group. And I'm like, what? And I was talking with one of the other guys that works for us, and he was like, he started using Substance, and he's like, yeah. the node groups, it needs node groups like what Blender has.
But on the other hand, what you can do with substance is brilliant.
Yeah, it is.
And all procedural, and you make a layer, it's a little bit of a Photoshop interface to map things, and then you can create superior textures that look so good.
Yeah.
And then you bake it and you export. I mean, that's a workflow.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I think they did a good job on the UI.
Oh, yeah.
For it.
Yeah,
it
really
feels
good.
Pleasant. It's modern. It's flat, too. That's a precision again.
That's true, yeah.
But they did a couple of good jobs on previews and the browsing and how they present things. Well done.
Yeah.
And that kind of level of designers we need on board.
Is when what?
We need that kind of designers who can work on that level.
Yeah.
And that's not, that requires experience.
Yeah, it's a hard job.
No, so I'm not collecting money for that. And,
you're not collecting
money? I'm collecting money for
To hire a UI guy.
One
really?
Of the first questions was how many people are working for the Blender Institute? So we have currently, as it goes up and down, between 8 and 12. That depends on what kind of project we do. They're not all developers, of course, half of them is artists. But how many people are working on Blender paid as developer via either foundation, because we give out grants, because my employees, or the institute? It's currently 8, I think.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to 10. And it depends. You don't count me then, because I'm not working on Blender. Huh? I'm
email.
Doing interviews.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So that's 8 to 10, and that's only growing.
Yeah.
I'm talking, and there's from the market, what you said, you notice that things are getting maybe exponential, but it's going up. I also know that. And I talk to studios and companies, they have Blender in the picture, and they think, yes, we're going to try. And we are going to support Blender Institute, we want to have some support, or we want to find out how to get Blender more efficiently in our companies. So what the bottleneck here is support and services companies. Mm. Everybody wants me to do that, to do support, but come on.
Support services.
Support and services.
Oh.
Like what Canonical does for Ubuntu or Red Hat for Linux. Or
That's a commercial opportunity for someone, isn't it?
Yeah, you can make billions with it. Go ahead. Please do it.
So that you mean like companies need someone to call on the phone?
Yep.
Yeah,
but also, hey, we have a character, but the right arm is twitching
right.
in a specific shot. Fix it.
Right.
You do that?
No. Hmm? Oh, if we had a team, you make money,
Yeah, but you need the people, you need to organize that. How do you do that?
Exactly.
It's a special type of work.
There wasn't Sebastian trying to...
Nah, they tried.
But didn't work.
The time is not ready. So it's a chicken egg thing. Because if you would have this company that would have support with a contract, and even when it's not 24/7 for online, but when it's only 10 hours per day on weekdays, still, right? If you can phone or make or have a chat thing and you can send them priority things to fix, it would work.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it would really work.
Yeah.
And I even asked a couple of other servicing companies what kind of business model they have behind it, and it's not too complicated. For example, the character with the arm doing weird, you can have a service contract that says that if you cannot solve it, you don't get paid.
It's
very fair.
That is
and
fair,
it's kind of an equal thing, because you get this thing in, and then you said, okay, we look at it. No, we don't do it.
Right.
We can't fix it. So, yeah. Sorry, we can't. We tried, but we can't. So you don't have to get paid.
That's a good
idea.
And
then you say, we can fix it. Will cost you 1,000. Okay, fix. What?
Yeah.
So that's not bad business, but you need to be commercial for that, and you need to be interested in money.
Well, maybe this can talk to the camera and say, "Hey, we got a." There's enough people that are starting up Blender render farms, aren't there?
So
we don't need another render farm.
I don't know why they do. They're nerds. They like computers. We need people who like people, who like to do business.
Support companies.
But
what
you
need.
Like business. Mm-hmm. You have employees.
Yeah, but I'm busy with the Polygon.
Yeah. Well, how big is Polygon now?
10 people.
Ten?
Yeah.
Full time.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Are they all working on their own locations?
Yeah, mostly Canada. Yeah.
In Canada?
Yeah, for some reason. They're all in Vancouver.
It's Vancouver?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
fun. It wasn't planned. Yeah. There's like one in Tennessee and then most of
Polygon is getting bigger than Guru.
Yeah, it's like more than twice the revenue. Yeah.
But Polygon is neutral, right? It's a texture system for...
Yeah. Yeah, so it's open to 3D's Mags, Maya, yeah.
But can you see that? In the, do you have questionnaires that people can tell you what kind of
software we should, but we don't.
Huh?
We should, but we don't.
Okay.
We don't have the user data yet, but...
Quick estimate or...
We could, I guess we could pull something from the help docs, but it's very rudimentary. We're going to, so in 2018, we're adding models to the site. So we will have support for 3ds Max, Maya, Octane, all the major renderers and the major software. And so we'll have data then on who downloads what. So that would be the information, but yeah.
Good business. But I talk around, if you ever meet people who say, they've done the thing, or what can I do for that, or what kind of business is needed? But people who like to organize stuff, especially for support and services, people who know other people, you can use the Blender Network for that. It's an open system. Mm-hmm. Everybody can see everybody who's there. They're all available. And there should be an intermediate mm-hmm. between the customer request and all the professionals out there.
Yeah.
And then you simply find the right solution for people.
Yeah.
And if you know, this is a problem, and then that person can fix it, that's worth gold, really.
Yeah.
Because most people have no idea.
Yeah.
You don't even have an idea.
I don't have an idea.
No. If you have a problem in Blender, you don't know how to fix it.
And I go to Twitter.
Yeah, you put it on Twitter.
That's what I use Twitter for. It's a great help desk. But yeah, somebody should make an Uber. You could connect the right artist with the solution.
That's the Uber Blender.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
$1 million idea. Yeah. So, cool. Well, you've got to shoot off. You've got to go to an agent.
Somehow my super watch thinks that I'm doing a dynamic workout.
Maybe you moved your arms too much.
Yeah, I'm talking too much with energy.
Well, good luck with that agent.
You got all the info.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Tom.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Take that, Autodesk.
Eat shit.
Yeah, you jerks in your FBX domination.
Horrible. But you know, this is to be fair, this is the thing that like could happen any day now with PDFs, for example. Like, he's right in examining the license on these things, because the PDF is itself also a proprietary Adobe format.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think their licensing is as extreme, but, like, they could just change how PDFs work. And then there'd be a year without PDFs.
I know, you see this. I use Windows, so I feel blocked off from so many of the little perks of being a Mac user.
Uh-huh.
Things that I take for granted, like iMessage.
Yeah.
Impossible over here.
Yeah.
On the other side of the Iron Curtain.
Run it in a virtual machine or something? Like, the most complicated way of having iMessage on a Windows thing is having, like, a tiny Mac running inside your Windows computer.
I think that's perhaps the difference between us, Steve, is I do like, I'm just like, I read the forum on it. I thought about it and I was like, I'm going to not do that today.
Hmm.
A kind of cost benefit analysis.
I don't have that capacity. I'm just like, all right, so the next 2 or 3 days, I'm just going to make iMessage work on another platform. And, It kind of worked.
Yeah. And you're like, I actually was able to, a week later, I was able to switch it so that your messages, you know, my messages are the green balloons and the other person is the blue balloon. How cool is that?
Yeah, totally. Mine are all written in Comic Sans for me.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like the way, other than like muscling their way into lots of industrial contracts, which trickle down to small businesses like the one I'm involved in, it's also just like when you're working at the speed of commerce, there are certain things that say like Blender, you know, no one's needed to make this part of it work smoothly. And
yeah.
And that part of it will slow me down a lot. So
yeah.
It's also, there's no corollary to Adobe in the 3D field yet.
Yeah.
Like no one's winning. Autodesk is winning, but not really. I mean, everyone I know uses like 5 different softwares.
Yeah.
Like the one they like the most that they're not supposed to use. And then they know one of like the common languages, you know, they uh-huh. basically all speak Pidgin.
I mean, it makes sense. And it's cool that the field is still open.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the things that's made it, like the rest of imaging software, so uncompelling.
Mm-hmm.
Like Photoshop's very boring to use, but there's no more market pressure for them to change it drastically. Or, you know, like I think about how like Ableton Live changed the DAW industry.
Yeah.
For example, like there was the way like a digital audio workstation would work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of the same, you know, like they were all a little different, but there's Pro Tools and Nuendo and Cubase and, you know, and this was how it worked. You would like plug in all the stuff and it worked kind of like a tape machine worked. And it makes sense because it was emulating the function of a tape machine in a mixing console. And then that's what you did. That's how you were. But you could go in and do like minuscule edits and it was easy to do. And then Ableton Live was like, how about if you were DJ?
Yeah.
You know, like, what if you want to do all of this but as like live music as opposed to like in studio after the fact? Yes. So you do it live. It's called Ableton Live, yes. And then like all the way from Berlin, and you know, people were like, "Oh, so like I can actually like use the DAW in real time." You know, it just like it changed everything. It made like doing DAW tasks like, if they were not specifically complicated DAW tasks involving, you know, banks and banks of outboard gear and sequencers and stuff like that, which most people were not doing, it just like shaved hours off of the amount of time you had to spend using the software. And, you know, like literally just like ripped the guts out of like regular DAWs. And then now that's basically one of the that. And like Pro Tools are the only two things people really use for that.
It's true. Know? It's true.
It's cool that these things changed. I don't know. It's like, it's interesting to think, but you know what? I mean, it's also cool to hear how Blender started out as a commercial software.
Yeah. Yeah. With a huge investment that
yeah.
went from 2 employees to 50 overnight and,
yeah, and then and sank sort of it. Organically reached this other position simply because it was useful.
Well, you know, that he fully and also was like he just pushed out by the market, right? There was a market. The market moved away from these 3D softwares for a bit.
Yeah. But then he open sourced it and expected it to just be like an archival thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as opposed to being a thing that actually like acquired its own community and life of its own.
That like I enjoyed the moment about you know, like the first release of the open source, and then
yeah.
you know, he had all these assumptions about what would be done, and
yeah.
the community just built a better modeler, and he was like, oh yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't think of that, but that I can see how that'd be useful.
yeah. That's what you guys wanted.
Oh wow, you wanted to make more accurate 3D models, not get things to spin out of control or whatever.
Yeah.
He thought they were going to want. Particle simulators or something.
Yeah. No, I think I think about that a lot because it's like lots of the things that I truthfully use every day in Emacs weren't even invented when Emacs was started in 40 years ago or so. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like every day you have to use Git a little bit, you know? And one has to use Git a little bit every day. And, you know, Git was not invented until, I think, the early aughts. you know, which is like already 20 years into Emacs being a thing, you know, and now there's like fluid facility for the, you know, it's like it's cool to watch things just develop themselves sort of organically because a community finds them useful.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's no comprehensive reason for things to necessarily be exactly another way, I guess, is the other negative criteria that's necessary, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Because it's like that's why there's no dominant open source Photoshop. That's why GIMP is always like a punchline,
right?
As opposed to like actually Photoshop or something. But
yeah, you'd think that the open source community would have really blown up during the lockdown, but it doesn't seem like it's had a big uptick, as far as I can tell.
You mean in terms of Blender users?
Just, you know, in terms of like the communities surrounding different open source softwares, or perhaps the release of new open source softwares. Just because, I mean, it seems like this whole NFT thing was born out of complete boredom.
Yeah. Oh God, NFTs.
Yeah, we don't have to go down that path if you don't want to, but it's a dark road. But you know, there have been so many like dumb internet things that have popped up in the last year that just seem born of boredom. You know, people just being very bored. Even the huge change, the huge uptick in crypto feels that way.
Yeah.
Oh, well, and for example, the GameStop thing. Definitely was just like pure boredom.
Pure boredom. I agree with you, but I think that on the one hand, the technologies behind crypto, for example, are open source technologies, like all of them, which is why people can develop in this space quickly. But then the thing that's dumb about those technologies in the first place is that they exist to try and like interact with the economy in a way that doesn't challenge any of the fundamental conceptions of the economy.
Yeah.
Right? Right. And so that's the, like, they're like, oh, the problem with the economy is centralization. And like, there are problems with the economy that stem from centralization. Okay, sure. You know,
mm-hmm.
But like the real problem with the economy is like the commodification of people's time and labor.
Yeah.
And then the speculation on such through a marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and I guess maybe more to the point with crypto is also the commodification of like the living earth.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's maybe the real, because otherwise, like if you want to do something goofy with computers, you know, like, all right, have at it. You know what I mean? But if you're like, I'm going to do something goofy with computers and it will use grotesque amounts of resources, you're a goblin, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like the third person perspective of say like an alien sci-fi film of them seeing the end of the earth. It's like, well, then they consumed all the energy on the earth to make digital coins.
Yeah. Huh,
that didn't seem so smart.
To make like a digital sneaker drop. Basically, right?
Yeah.
And like, so it's like the reason why we scoff or feel like that technology is bullshit is because it's doing exactly the same thing as the existing economy, just in sort of a digital realm where
well, you know, now that we're doing the show remotely, we don't have Gunter here to help us out, and sometimes there are occasional technical difficulties, so I'm sorry to say that we've lost Steve Cato, not from this mortal world, but from the dissemination of electronic or voices through electronic waves. But so we'll sign off for tonight. Thanks, Ton, for your talking, and to Blender Guru for the clever questions you asked. Good morning, Chinatown.